You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Fast Money starts right now, live from the Nasdaq market site overlooking New York City's Times Square. I'm Melissa Lear. Traders on the desk are Tim Seymour, Brian Kelly, Dan Nathan, and Guy Adami. Tonight on Fast, Amazon's retail mania, the stock soaring to another all-time high as the company is now worth nearly $600 billion. But history suggests December could be a cruel month. We'll explain what we mean. Plus, you know what goes with great turkey and stuffing? Bitcoin, of course. It's the rally that just won't quit. The cryptocurrency surging toward $10,000 coming off the holiday week. And he is the man who said Bitcoin would double to $10,000 back in October, right here on Fast Money. Hedge fund legend Mike Novogratz is back. You will not believe what he sees for the cryptocurrency next. He's here exclusively. But first, we start off with some breaking news. The embargo lifting right now off of Fed chair nominee Jerome Powell's testimony ahead of his confirmation hearing tomorrow. Let's get to Steve Liesman in the newsroom with the details. Steve.
Melissa, thanks very much. Jerome Powell, the Fed chairman nominee, nominated earlier this month by President Trump, will say in testimony before Senate banking tomorrow that he expects rates to rise, quote, somewhat further and the balance sheet to gradually shrink. He pledges to preserve the Fed's independent, nonpartisan status and says transparency and accountability must accompany that Fed independence. That is a nod to some critics, particularly from the Republican Party in the Senate and in Congress. He says he will look for ways to enhance that transparency and accountability, but goes on to say, I am a strong supporter of the current Fed structure. That's a bit of a pushback on some who want to change that structure in Congress. Goes on to say his aim or the aim of the Fed is to sustain a strong jobs market and will have gradually rising inflation. The Fed must retain, he says, flexibility to adjust policies. Another bit of a pushback against those who want to do a monetary policy rule. Here's a couple quotes. From him. He says, quote, we must be prepared to respond decisively and with appropriate force to new and unexpected threats to our nation's financial stability and economic prosperity. Reading between the lines there a little bit, that is a pushback against those who might take away some of those powers, even a bit of concern on his part about some of the powers taken away from the Fed in the financial crisis in the Dodd-Frank reform. Goes on to say the financial system is stronger, more resilient than a decade ago, and supports the higher capital levels of banks, but goes on to say, quote, we'll continue to consider appropriate ways to ease regulatory burdens while preserving core reform. So, Melissa, a bit of subtext here where the chair nominee talks about certain issues that are likely to come up and sort of laying out how he feels about those ideas. Ultimately, it sounds like a very much status quo idea when it comes to monetary policy, with perhaps a bit more give when it comes to the regulatory side.
It doesn't sound like much of a departure, in fact, from what Janet Yellen has said. So I'm curious, within these comments that you have read, does he say much about inflation, about the prospect of inflation actually gaining some steam?
Just the one notion that he expects to have a strong job market with inflation gradually rising towards the Fed's target. That is a big question, given what Janet Yellen said last week about her being uncertain that the current low inflation is transitory. The last comments that I saw he made to me in August in Jackson Hole, where he said low inflation's a bit of a mystery. But he hasn't spoken since then, and we don't know if he is more uncertain than he was back in August.
Probably even more of a mystery at this point, since it hasn't really done anything since that period of time. I mean, reading through these comments, Steve, what do you think will be sort of the touch points that congressional leaders will actually just latch on to?
You know, it'll be interesting to see how much the Fed is a political issue now, Melissa. Mm-hmm. There are four members of the Senate Banking Committee, I would point out, that voted against Jerome Powell when he was a nominee of President Obama. And now, apparently, they're expected to vote for him. Mike Crapo, the Senate Banking Chairman, said he voted against Powell as a protest vote against the nominees of President Obama. So now he'll be asked to vote for Jerome Powell as Fed Chairman. I'm not hearing a lot of discussion about the Fed right now. It's more about tax cuts in Congress. And it's interesting to point out that the Fed is sort of off the boil when it comes to the political discussion, with a lot of the opponents of the Federal Reserve in Congress, they really lost this battle in the White House when President Trump picked Jerome Powell. There were other more controversial nominees who might have brought the Fed and the way it conducts policy more to the fore.
All right, Steve, thank you. Steve sure. Leisman, back at headquarters for us. Tim, what do you think of these comments?
Well, it's always interesting. We need to hear more and more about how he views. Sounds like status quo. You heard, though, gradually in terms of interest rates. You heard decisively in terms of inflation. It's interesting, over the last 3 weeks, couple months even, you've heard different Fed members talk about different measures of inflation and what might be more appropriate. We've been critical. I've been critical. I think many have been critical of using the PCE. That's a measure of inflation. Personal consumption expenditures is one that the Fed certainly looks at, and in that regard, they're getting inflation still well below 2% with a labor market that has run out of slack. Dallas Fed governor this morning, Rob Kaplan, pointed out the market, and he said, actually, I'm a little worried about a stock market where market cap to GDP is 135%. We haven't been this high since 1999. He talked about not having a 3% correction, and he talked about inflation. So, you know, within the Fed, I think we're getting a different dialogue, and I applaud the transparency, because I think people have never believed that transparency, and they've been nothing but.
Well, we'll see, right? I mean, if you look at what happened with the dollar, got a little bit stronger, but then completely reversed on this. So the market's telling you that there's not a lot in this speech that's going to change. But it says to me that still the most important chart to equity investors is TLT. When you start to see TLT dropping and 10-year yields getting towards 3%, that's your warning sign if you're a stock market investor. And that's what this speech to me and what we'll see tomorrow is saying, is that we're going to get higher rates. That could be an issue for the equity market.
Well, it's not just the Federal Reserve that D.C. is dealing with here. I mean, in fact, it's a whole slate of things. Call it the days of our D.C. lives. The stack calendar on Capitol Hill with just 11 working days for Congress left until the end of the year, and some of the most important legislation out of the Trump administration hanging in the balance. With everything from the debt ceiling to tax reform still on the table, is this a recipe that could actually wreck the rally going into year end? Supposedly a very seasonally strong time.
Or is it the recipe that actually gives fuel to the year end rally? I mean, you could look at it that way as well. Yes, it could wreck this rally without question. I would submit, though, something's going to get jammed through in the way of tax reform and regulation by the end of the year. I'm not certain it'll be exactly what both sides want, but something will get done. And I think the market will interpret that as bullish information. And I think this rally will continue. Whether or not, you know, we can have the conversation about the Federal Reserve. We can talk about the 2-10 spread now at 60 basis points and moving at an alarming pace. Although Tony Dwyer would talk about this being a bullish opportunity and a buying opportunity equities market. There's clearly something going on. But I think instead of being something that will derail the rally, I think this is something that will add fuel to the fire.
Yeah, Dan?
All right, so maybe this is all wish casting, but we have a few dates that we can look out to. And, you know, obviously this budget deal is a really important one. And obviously there's other issues other than just the budget that's going to come to fore with this thing. So to me, I think you have a handful of things. There's 6 Republican senators now are on the fence for this tax deal. I don't think we're going to get this passed anytime soon. I think we're going to get to the budget thing. I think things are going to remain very political, and I don't think we're going to have some sort of grand compromise there. And then we have December 12th. We have this Senate election in Alabama, which is proving to be a bit of a mess. And I think the Republicans have a difficult scenario no matter what happens down there. So at the end of the day, we have a situation where we could be all through December. Things could really be as volatile as they've been.
Listen.
We don't have tax reform in the year end. And then we have a very ugly January.
So, one, do you really think that they're not going to pass tax reform? If they don't pass tax reform, nobody gets reelected. That's the biggest thing. Senators being on the fence, that's what they do. That's their entire job, is to be on the fence.
Destruction, which is why tax reform is going to get passed.
Precisely. So to me, I don't know.
I don't think so. Think about this, guys. Okay, we know what the majority is in the Senate. There's 3 senators in the Republican Party who are not running for re-election. Okay, one of them derailed, obviously, the whole health care bill this
summer. They derail it because it's in their best interest, but this isn't in their best interest.
So you know what the Senate just added to this tax bill, BK? A repeal of the individual mandate.
They're going to add all kinds of stuff.
So with your view,
this is what politics is.
With my view,
what do you do in your portfolio? Are you?
I think you have to be cautious as you think about into January. I think that there's not going to be a full-on sell-off in December. I think people have a lot of really good gains in almost every risk asset that you can imagine. But at the end of the day, I actually think if tax fails, you're going to have a bipartisan tax plan reform, real reform, not cuts. Reform in 2018. Your gains in 2018, and you're more likely to have lower tax rates.
So pessimistic and yet very optimistic at the same time.
Well, because what's going to happen is
you think if this doesn't go through, we then ultimately get to,
they need to do
bipartisan.
They have to.
Right.
If you're going to go back and get reelected in the midterms, Wait, so you have a ruling majority. You can't get anything done all of 2017. You got to show your constituents that you're working for them and you're willing to go across the aisle and get something done.
I would prefer to look at it from the market's perspective. And let's be really clear. This is a market that is extremely bullish. Even though it's off of the record highs, it's still extremely bullish. We're at cash levels that are back to 2013. People have always talked about the cash that was on the sidelines. I think there's a lot of cash in this market. I think the market in January, that's also, let's talk about December. Enjoy that, because January clearly has been the nastiest month of the year outside of September for the last decade. And that is a place where I think you have to be very cautious, because I don't believe anything gets done this year. I believe something gets jammed in. I think a lot of people believe they can get something done, whether it has something to affect the economy. The economy is doing fine right now.
Is something done enough to keep us at these levels?
For December, yeah. For December, I think it's going to be very difficult to have the market sell off in December, particularly when you have won the seasonality, you have the gains. Why would I sell anything before next year? So, you know, what do you do with your portfolio? I think the most prudent thing to do is to protect your portfolio into January. The one thing that I would agree with Dan on is that come January, you could see a lot of tax loss selling that didn't take place in December. So why not buy some puts on your portfolio out to January? I think you can learn about that on a show on Friday, right?
5:30. The OA.
Yeah. It was usurped this past Friday.
But let's say that as Dan has outlined, tax reform doesn't really get passed. Gets punted for some reason. That the budget discussion is extremely political. But then on the other side, you got extreme seasonality. You got people who made some pretty good gains in the year. What wins?
Under Dan's scenario, I think we tread water to the end of the year. Tread water being, you know, sideways to slightly higher. Under my scenario, where I think something gets ratcheted through, I think you got another maybe 3 to 5% of upside potentially in the month of December. I mean, you could see one of these year-end melt-ups that we've seen before. January is a whole different issue. I mean, we saw January, I think it was last January, we had down 18 to 20%. It was a pretty significant move. But in December, I think the market continues to go
higher. I would just get back to you, though. I mean, if you look below the surface, this is Lake Placid on the surface. It looks lovely. But if you look below the surface, there's a lot of stuff. We're growing numbers of 52-week lows. We've got the transports that are not cooperating. Financials are not cooperating. I think these are places to be cautious, even though the headline looks okay.
For more on this, let's bring in Rebecca Patterson, Chief Investment Officer at Bessemer Trust. Rebecca, good to see you again.
Good to see you, too.
What do you think? Is it Lake Placid, or I mean, what's going on here in the market?
Is it the duck on the surface with the feet pedaling going wildly?
Yeah.
I mean, no one knows exactly what's going to happen with the tax reform tax bill. I don't think the legislators even know exactly what will happen. It's all negotiations right now. So we're all investing on the back of probabilities. I think they'd love to jam something through, especially before the election in Alabama, because the numbers, relatively speaking, are more on their side. But can they get the reconciliation done? You know, that's the hard part. So even if the Senate gets its bill done by this Friday, can you reconcile it before year end with everything else on the legislative agenda? It's really hard. Not impossible, but really hard. But I think to the point earlier, they need something done politically before we get to the spring midterm election campaign season. So whether it's now or later, I think it's still coming to the point of, can the market go up without it? You know, at the end of the day, I always come back to, what's the economic underpinnings of this? You know, we got home sales today that were extremely strong, going up the last 3 months in a row. Jobless claims still near cycle lows, unemployment rate at decade lows. You know, whether we're looking at business sentiment, consumer sentiment, both coming out later this week, staying near highs. So if you get a dip on disappointment around legislation in the short term, I think it's probably a dip that's going to get bought, because the global economy, the U.S. economy, is still doing very well. And I think they probably will get something done, whether it happens in December or at some point in Q1. If I knew that, I would be a rock star.
You are a rock star.
We have to come up with something else. So if I were a client, Rebecca, and I said to you, I'm really concerned with the markets at record highs right now. I'm feeling very uncomfortable going into year end. Tell me what to do.
Yeah. I mean, and I hear that all the time. Everyone's uncomfortable, right? We're all enjoying making good profits this year. But you see the valuations and you see what's going on politically, and it's scary. So, I mean, we're telling our clients, stay invested. If you are already invested, we run diversified portfolios. We've been early. We took some risk off the table. We've gone neutral on equities. We have some defensive exposures in our equities. So we've lagged the market a little bit this year, in part to be ready for when that downturn does come. And I think that's a trade-off. Every individual investor has to decide how they want to make it. If you're putting new money to work right now, I think as long as the economic fundamentals stay strong, you're okay. But I think the point was made earlier, inflation and how does the Fed react? you know, starting in March next year, base effects are going to start to take inflation higher. And then we start to see CPI and PCE and all the Fed's favorite inflation metrics start to crawl higher. Does the Fed still go gradually? Do they hike faster than expected? To me, that's the answer to everything.
Is that your number one concern?
My number one concern next year is, does inflation go higher than expected, and what does the Fed do?
Rebecca, good to see you. Thanks
for coming
by. Great
to see all of you.
Rebecca Patterson of
My Rock Stars.
Trust.
Thank you.
What'd you do today?
I didn't do much, sat around and watched, but I will say I thought the bond market was surprisingly strong. Given it was an auction, it was not particularly good. And the fact that rates stay stubbornly low. I heard somebody on Closing Bell saying that there was huge money, huge inflows into the bond market this year. And what are people doing? Rates are going higher, was his comment. I'm not so sure rates are going higher. Maybe in the front end of the curve, not in the back end of the curve. So I look at twos, tens, and say there's something going on here.
I think you can trade some of the higher beta stuff in your portfolio. So I started to fade a little bit of EM exposure late last week when, again, it went parabolic. It's outperformed the S&P by 1,800 basis points. As we say in EM, you can always get things a little bit cheaper. I do think some of this is going to come down. You look at the outsized move to the downside today, I think you can buy it lower.
All right, coming up, the man who called Bitcoin hitting $10,000 just last month is back. Mike Novogratz is here, and he's got an even bolder call on the cryptocurrency. You will not want to miss it. Plus, a top analyst just declared war on the chip stocks. At least that's according to one of our traders. We'll tell you what it could mean for all the hottest trades of the year. And later, Amazon's retail mania, the stock soaring as the company is now worth nearly $600 billion. But are the gains in for this year? History suggests yes. We will explain what we mean. Much more Fast Money right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Time now for our move of the day. Check out the SMH, the semiconductor ETF, taking a hit today, down more than 1% after a couple downgrades from Morgan Stanley calling for a peak in chip prices. Samsung, Western Digital, each getting a downgrade. Micron also a loser on the day. So, Dan, what do you make of this?
Well, I think it makes sense. I mean, what they're talking about is limited visibility beyond Q1 of next year. So what they're really saying is you had this build up into this smartphone super cycle. It was a memory super cycle in the lead up to it. But it's not just smartphones. It was also servers for a whole host of reasons. A lot of buzzwords that we've all been talking about. So at the end of the day, you have the SMH, which was up almost 50% year to date. It's massively outperforming the NASDAQ, nearly 2x the performance. So I think this makes a lot of sense, especially when you consider a lot of the performance in the semiconductor space over the last 2 years has been M&A driven. And we know we're kind of getting to the end of this cycle of mega deals. Maybe there's one or two left. So to me, SMH, you ask these guys what they did today. I'm adding to this position on the short side. I think this is one that's very vulnerable in January. I think that investors are going to try to hold on until the end of the year. But this is one in January I expect outsized returns to the downside relative to tech in general.
I mean, Morgan Stanley said that NAND prices already started to reverse in the fourth quarter of this year. So right now, basically, does this say anything about the end user of the memory?
No, I don't think it does. Okay. I think it's just something about the commoditization of certain parts of memory and certain parts of the chip world. You know, if you listen to Taiwan Semiconductor, TSM is the ADR, arguably one of the biggest in the world. Their call is that basically chips grow at GDP plus 200 to 300 basis points over the next decade. A lot of it's AI, a lot of it's data center, a lot of it's different parts, even, you know, lithography. I mean, there's different places these guys are actually seeing that kind of growth. So I think this is an economic call.
Well, I think that's the thing you got to look at, right? You broaden it out a bit and say, okay, this has been one of the leaders of the market here. So if I'm looking for warning signals, if I'm looking for the duck flapping its, what is it, the duck's legs under Lake Placid?
Yes.
Is that, if I'm looking for that, this is the duck's legs, right? This is where you might say, okay, some of the leaders are cracking here, and maybe not everything is great under the surface. So I'd look at this and say, you know what, warning sign here. Keep this on your screens as something to watch into 2018.
I have one really important point to make, is that also this
At least, as opposed to all the other points you made.
They were all equally important. How's that? Now, the iPhone super cycle. Okay, the iPhone 8 and the iPhone X. This year, the entry level was 64 gigabytes of memory. The next level was 256. Yeah. The spread of 192 is massive. They've never had that wide a spread. So when you think about demand for NAND in the lead up to these phones, I think that has a lot to do with it. Once we get by these next two quarters, you may see a dramatic drop off.
All right. Still ahead. Stocks at record high. So what is Wall Street getting wrong about this rally? Well, quite a bit. But it could be a major buy sign. We'll explain why. I'm Melissa Lee. You're watching Fast Money on CNBC, First in Business Worldwide. In the meantime, here's what else is coming up on Fast.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. Not if you're Amazon, because history suggests the top might be in for the year. We'll explain. Plus,
it would not surprise me if in the next 6 to 10 months we're over 10,000.
Talk about a crypto baller of a call. Now, Mike Novogratz, the man who called Bitcoin 10K, is back. And he'll tell us where he sees the cryptocurrency going next when Fast Money returns.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Black Friday weekend wasn't just a big one for retailers, but for Bitcoin as well. The cryptocurrency now marching towards $10,000. Seema Modi is back at headquarters breaking it all down. Hey, Seema.
Hey, Melissa, that's right. What's striking is just the speed of the Bitcoin rally. The move from 8,000 to 9,000 took only 7 days, the fastest 1,000-point jump on record for the cryptocurrency. And at $9,586, Bitcoin's market cap has reached $160 billion, making it bigger than GE, Boeing, and Disney. Coinbase, the largest Bitcoin exchange, added an estimated 300,000 users just in the past week alone as more retail investors opened accounts during the holiday weekend. Coinbase now has more users than brokerage Charles Schwab, which in mid-November reported it had 10.6 million active brokerage accounts in October, compared to Coinbase's 11.7 million users, that according to data compiled by Atlanta Digital Currency Fund. While Bitcoin continues to climb, but more influential investors like Citadel CEO Ken Griffin remain cautious. Here's what he told CNBC's Leslie Picker earlier today on Squawk Alley.
Bitcoin right now has many of the elements of the tulip ball mania that we saw back hundreds of years ago in Holland. But these bubbles tend to end in tears, and I worry about how this bubble might end.
My next big test for Bitcoin will be the CME Group's launch of the Bitcoin futures contract set for December 10th. Melissa, as we were discussing.
All right, Seema, thank you. Seema Modi with the latest on Bitcoin. BK, what do you make of this recently?
Are you tearing up?
I'm not tearing up yet. I mean,
laughter at Ken Griffin, or what are you talking about?
Well, I mean, first of all, the tulip bulb analogy to me is laughable. I mean, listen, tulip bulbs didn't disrupt an industry. This is a technology that's disrupting financial services. I can't point to exactly what tulip bulbs disrupted, so I don't know. I think it's a terrible analogy,
and
people should stop using it. In terms of what drove this, a lot of retail buying, really interesting to see the surge of buying after Thanksgiving. So I put a little chart here together. You see that small little box where Bitcoin and all the other three currencies that Coinbase trades going down? That's during Thanksgiving. People literally eating turkey, talking to the family, telling them how great cryptocurrencies is. And then look at the surge. As soon as the banks open on Friday and fiat money can come into the system, boom, you get this massive surge of the three coins that are traded at Coinbase, which is where everybody is kind of the funnel that U.S. investors come in. So really interesting. I think a lot of retail people just said, hey, I want in on this trend.
Oh. Back in October, Galaxy Investment Partners CEO and hedge fund legend Mike Novogratz called for Bitcoin to rally to $10,000. Here's what he said.
It would not surprise me if in the next 6 to 10 months we're over 10,000.
Well, at the rate Bitcoin's going, we won't need a couple of months. The cryptocurrency has almost doubled since that call, sitting at less than $500 away from that $10,000 mark. We will probably hit $10,000 in the next 5 minutes or so. Question now, how much higher could Bitcoin go? What is fueling this rally? We have brought Mike Novogratz back to answer those burning questions for us. Mike, it's always great to see you. Thanks
for
coming
back. Good to see you.
What's your next call?
My next call? Put me on the spot. Listen, I mean, to start with, you know, trees don't grow to the sky, and the pace of this move has been really fast. And so on one hand, lots of the speculative, sensors are out. You know, the amount of retail customers coming in, the amount of phone calls I get, that gets me a little bit nervous that we could have a short-term top. On the other hand, when I step back, I'm like, wait a minute. The whole market cap of all the crypto is $300 billion. That's nothing. The NASDAQ at its high in the 1999 bubble was $6 trillion. And the NASDAQ was a U.S.-led, bubble. This is a global phenomenon. 60-70% of all trading volume in these cryptos are happening in Japan and Korea. And so I have a sense that this is going to go a lot further. When I try to think of valuation, Bitcoin really has taken the use case of digital gold. Gold's $8 trillion or $7.5 trillion. And so at 150 billion Bitcoin, 30 times, 40 times, 50 times higher than here, then you're starting to look like Bitcoin's replaced gold, or at least it's on parity of gold. And so my short-term call, I guess, is things have gone pretty far, and maybe you'll backfill a little bit. But over the medium term, you know, this thing is going to go a lot higher. I said recently I thought total market cap by the end of next year would be a trillion. You know, that's probably a little light, but if it's a trillion to 2 trillion, that's kind of 6x from where we are now. And it's not all going to go into Bitcoin.
60,000 from where we are?
Sorry, six times.
Oh, six times, okay.
Six times 200.
Okay. Oh, okay.
300 billion.
Six times 300 billion gets you a $2 trillion market cap by the end of 2018. And, you know, there's Ethereum, there's Bitcoin Cash, there's EOS, there's all kinds of protocols.
So what are the assumptions? I mean, you made the parallel to the NASDAQ during the bubble days and the total market cap of the NASDAQ back then. What is the assumption on how high Bitcoin could go? Is there an assumption in your head?
Well, I look at gold.
Is it all of the market cap of gold right now?
Why not in some ways? And so each of these tokens represent individual ecosystems, right? There's one for cloud computing. There's one for file sharing. There's one for online gambling. Bitcoin is the ecosystem of digital money or digital store wealth. And it's really more digital store wealth or digital gold. And so if gold's 8 trillion, I don't understand why Bitcoin can't get there.
So, Mike, everybody asks me, what derails this? What keeps you up at night, right? We know the bull case, it's working, but you wake up one day and this one thing happens. What is it that scares you?
Well, I'd hate for myself to get hacked, because that would really suck. but a really major exchange being hacked in a major way. We've had plenty of small hacks, people, and small in comparison to market cap, but a major hack or a real change of mindset on the regulators. Right now, most regulators have been working with the system. We work a lot ourselves with the regulators. If for some reason they woke up and did an about face, that would be no good.
So, Mike, you mentioned that you're kind of getting a little nervous about this speculative fervor. You know, I've heard you on a few occasions talk about you started buying Ethereum in the low single digits, right?
Yes.
And so now it's just below 500. So how do you get, you know, all these people are opening up these hundreds of thousands of Coinbase accounts just in the last couple of weeks. How do you go out and talk to these people about what the opportunity is? For you, you knew that you could lose a few dollars when you paid a few dollars for Ethereum. Now it's almost $500. And it's really hard to talk about the long-term vision to 2 trillion and all of these. You know what I mean?
So
how do
So what I tell people, you know, the retail type customer, I said, put 1 to 3% of your net worth in it. Because if it goes down 50%, it's like buying 1 to 3% of Google and it goes down 50%. For wealthier people who can afford a little bigger loss, yeah, take it to 5% or even 10%. But I don't recommend anybody throw their entire net worth into this.
What is your net worth in terms of how much is tied up?
You know, I'm probably over 20% at this point. And, you know, because it keeps going up and I take some off and then I get, why am I taking it off and I buy more? And maybe it's even 30%.
What do you think about futures? The CME is going to launch futures for Bitcoin. December 10th is the date right now. What does that do to Bitcoin, if anything? Does it suppress volatility? Does it cause more volatility?
I think in the short run, the future will not be as exciting as people are hoping it will, because it's going to take a while for it to build liquidity. The really promising part of the future, though, is when you have a future, you'll need a stock borrow. You know, and all of a sudden you'll have a lending market in Bitcoin. And as soon as you have a lending market in Bitcoin, guess what? Then you have an interest rate curve in Bitcoin. And all of a sudden, Bitcoin starts looking more like a currency than it ever did. You know, it's very difficult right now. There's not an efficient market to buy it, to borrow or lend against all of these coins. And I think the future market will really accelerate that.
Is there a trading opportunity surrounding the launch and the early days of Bitcoin futures?
I think this march of institutionalization of the whole crypto space is just a positive. And so the fact that the CME is credentializing this is a huge win. And I think that's part of what's driven the price up here. I think once it gets going and starts building liquidity, just more access to the market.
Mike, you mentioned that Bitcoin with the yield curve could look more like a currency. So what, if anything, does the future of Bitcoin mean to currencies, the U.S. dollar, I mean, global currencies?
In the short run, nothing. Why? Because currencies need real stability, right? I've said this before, the dollar versus the yen, which I focused on very closely for 25 years of my life, quite frankly, never moves more than plus or minus 6% in a year, maybe 10%. My wife once said, are you going to spend your whole career looking at that little squiggly line? Bitcoin is moving too fast with too much volatility to ever really be a currency, right? This water can't cost a dollar one day and $6 a month later. And so until there's real stability in price,
it won't be used as a
currency. Bears will say that that's the exact reason why Bitcoin isn't any kind of currency, that it's its
own
gold, thing.
But, Gold, when's the last time you bought a pair of shoes in gold? Right? Never. Or even a pair of shoes in a quarter of a Google share. Never.
The argument is also that you can't speculate in currencies when, in fact, I think people are speculating in currencies all the time. The ranges are then levered up, but they're smaller ranges, but they are. But you know, you talk about the risks here, and you talk about you getting hacked. How do you protect a digital wallet in this day and age? And what are people doing to because the amount of wealth that they have stored here is almost, this is the part that's difficult for me. Not difficult for me to see why it's going higher and why people want to own it. How do you protect yourself?
So, you know, when it was a small amount of money, you didn't worry about it so much. It becomes a big amount of money, you start worrying about it a lot. The exchanges, the custody places, and places like us who both self-custody and use custody places, you take your keys off the internet. And so it's called cold storage. You actually put your private keys on a computer in a safe, and you put that safe in a really safe place. That's safe. The percentage of your coins that you want to leave active to be able to trade back and forth, those have more risk in it. Now, let's say you put some on Coinbase and some on Gemini and some on the various exchanges. Each of those places is doing the same thing. They're keeping 90% of their coins offline. And so if I put 10% of my coins online in 10 different places, 1% in each, and they're doing that, all of a sudden I have very, very little, you know, at risk to a hack. And so that's why this is a lot safer than it feels, as long as you're using prudent risk management.
I'm going to go back to the first question that I asked you in this interview, and that is your forecast for Bitcoin. Give me a level for 2018. Where do you see Bitcoin going? You're very decisive in your interview
last
month,
and
you're very spot on.
Listen, Bitcoin could be at 40,000 at the end of the 2018. It really easily could. And I think Ethereum, you know, which I think just touched 500 or is getting close, could be triple where it is as well. There's a big wave of money coming, not just here, but all around the world. And, you know, as we push more people into the system, both retail and institutional, what's different about these coins than other commodities? So, like, when the price of oil went up to $150, what happened? You know, we started drilling in the Canadian tar sands. We started going deep sea in Brazil. We started investing in solar and fracking and everything else. And there's a supply response. There is no supply response here. So it's a speculator's dream in that as buying happens, there's no new supply that comes out. And so every price moves gets exaggerated. It's going to get exaggerated on the way up, and there will be 50% corrections. It will get exaggerated on the way down.
So people read about the mining farms all over the world in China. They have huge warehouses, and they're just filled with Bitcoin miners. So that doesn't count as supply coming on in response to prices that are going higher.
No. So that's just what it means is as prices go higher, it gets more difficult to mine those coins because it's more valuable. More people are chasing each coin. But there's a total amount of Bitcoins that will ever be mined. It was 21 million, apparently up to 3 million or 4 million have been lost forever. And so total supply of Bitcoin is really set. And so the miners really are used to authenticate and validate the blockchain.
So here's a question. This is from my mother, who just opened her own Coinbase account a couple months ago. So, Mom, if you're listening, would you rather Bitcoin or Ethereum here? Or Litecoin? Let's throw that in. Of the three.
You know, I have roughly half of Bitcoin and half of Ethereum. I don't like Litecoin nearly as much. It seems like the poor man's Bitcoin to me. Bitcoin and Ethereum have very different use cases. Bitcoin really is this ecosystem of digital store wealth, and Ethereum is one of the contenders to be the ecosystem of really kind of the decentralized computer that most of these projects get built off of. But I'm also spreading my bets because, you know, I learned in the Chinese internet where I picked one company which went to zero and every other company would have made me a fortune, that nobody's smart enough to really understand how this future of an industry that's changing as rapidly as this one is. And so I've got lots of bets as hedges in other ecosystems, you know, and so that makes it kind of like a half venture business and half long short equity business.
Okay. Mike, good to see you again. Hope you come back soon.
Thanks so much.
Galaxy Investments. BK.
Well, it's interesting that Mike talked about the mining and the supply response, right? We had this report that possibly 3 to 4 million of the Bitcoin are lost or locked up or something like that. So if you think about it, there's 21 million Bitcoin that'll ever be out there. There's 16 million in existence. Let's say there's 4 million that are lost that can never be moved. Now you're at 20 million. That means there's only a million Bitcoin left for people to buy, in a sense. So it's a massive, I think that was also part of the big move that we had. That's a 25% of the supply that has been taken out. So that, I think, was really interesting. One thing is very different, like Mike said, about this versus commodities.
I'm going to bring something up. Steve Grasso's mentioned this. It's important to mention, Overstock was a $30 stock when Steve started talking about it, on the back of what they were doing in Bitcoin. The stock traded $65.70 today. I bring it up because it reversed. It closed down 9.5%. I'm not certain that Overstock
Look what Square did today.
On a downgrade.
On a downgrade based upon this exact point.
Very interesting, though. So what does it mean for the price? I don't know, but I think it's worth watching because the two were trading in tandem.
Yeah, I would just make one other point. What he just mentioned about, Mike mentioned about Bitcoin versus Ethereum. When you think about Ethereum, it really is more of a VC-centric sort of thing. You know, this is what companies and entire platforms are being built on. That, so to me, two very different things. The store of value with Bitcoin, you think it's going to $40,000, but there's going to be a lot of opportunities built on the Ethereum network, too.
And a quick Price is Right on Mike's forecast, Bitcoin to $40,000 next year. Is the price right, higher or lower?
You know what? I'll go out on a limb. I'll go higher. I don't know if it goes higher from exactly here. We might get a dip first, but I'll say higher.
All right. Still ahead, Amazon soaring to new highs after crushing Black Friday. But if history is any indication, the top could be in for the year. We will explain. Plus, it is a rally that Wall Street just can't get behind. A majority of strategists missing the mark this year, and it looks like there could be a bunch of timid bulls next year, too. But we'll tell you why that might be a good thing for the markets. Much more Fast Money right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Amazon dominating Black Friday weekend with Cyber Monday also looking strong for the online retail giant. Courtney Reagan is nearby the Amazon Center in Robbinsville, New Jersey with the very latest. Hey, Court.
Hi, Melissa. So we don't actually have the final numbers from Amazon yet, but I think it's pretty safe to say that the online behemoth really did rule the day. But when we're talking about records, are they hitting a record? Well, it depends what your benchmark is. Prime Day this year was actually Amazon's biggest day. Yes, it was 30 hours, so maybe that counts for something. Last Cyber Monday, Amazon shipped 64 million items from those customer orders. So that's the benchmark number that we're looking to beat for today. But 44% of online sales on an average day come from Amazon. That's according to eMarketer. Dan Ives of GBH Insight actually thinks that Black Friday and Cyber Monday could have been closer to 50% for Amazon. We'll have to wait and see if we get any of those actual metrics. And the shares hit an all-time high today, which is pretty rare for Amazon on Cyber Monday. As a matter of fact, in the last 5 years, only one time in 2012 were Amazon shares higher on Cyber Monday. All other Cyber Mondays in the last 5 years, those shares were lower. Now, Adobe says that as of 4:30 p.m., $3.38 billion was spent online. That's up 16.8% year over year. Their estimates for the full day is that we'll see sales hit $6.6 billion online. That would be a record U.S. e-commerce day. Of course, we know that's dwarfed in comparison when we look at Alibaba's Singles Day. That was more than $25 billion. But 6.6 is the number that we're looking to hit. Let's see if we can do it and if Amazon help us get there. Melissa, back to you.
All right. Courtney Reagan, thanks so much. In a forest near an Amazon fulfillment center, apparently. Despite the record-breaking number, do you see those trees in the background? They're like white, beautiful, straight trees, but
birch,
in the dark.
Yeah. River birch.
Nice.
Scary.
Cyber Monday may actually not be as much of a boon for Amazon as you think. For the past 8 years, going back to 2009, Amazon has actually underperformed the market in six of those eight times from Cyber Monday, leading into the end of the year, even through the holiday season. So should you still buy Amazon once the Cyber Monday craze is over, or is this year going to be different, Dan?
Well, listen, the stock gapped up to new all-time highs today, yeah. And like Courtney said, it's never traded that way on Cyber Monday. It did close on the lows, and the stock is also up about 22% or so from its Q3 earnings report. So I think there's a bit of enthusiasm kind of baked in here. And then when you look at the backdrop of just how few other retailers, or actually at least their stocks, are performing, we obviously know Walmart is doing very well. I say to myself, I don't know, there's a lot of enthusiasm captured in two stocks here, and it seems like a difficult setup into the new year. So to me, I think you get this thing back towards that breakout out level near, you know, 1050 or something like that. That's probably a better level.
Yeah, I think Amazon, look, it always seems like it's priced to perfection. We certainly had a couple of events in the last 6 months that have made you feel like Amazon could do no wrong. What's different about this Cyber Monday is I think a lot of the other retailers are in a different position than they were a year ago. So inventory levels are at a very different place. They have a strategy. In many cases, they have an online presence that feels different even to a customer that's used to Amazon. So I'll just take it from the other side. I think it's all about market perception. The bar has been so low, the perception has been so low on the major retailers, department stores, you name it. I think that's why Amazon is somewhat muted from here out.
All right. So ahead, the street's top strategists weren't bullish enough this year, and it looks like they're making the same mistake for next year. So why won't Wall Street go full bull? We've got a special report. Plus, traders getting on one group of stocks that has massively underperformed this year. We'll tell you what it is after this break. Much more Fast Money still ahead. Welcome back to Fast Money. It is the rally that Wall Street just can't catch. Strategists seriously missed the mark with their 2017 market predictions, and it looks like they're taking a page out of the same playbook for 2018. So let's get to a man who never misses the mark, Dom Chu in the newsroom. Hey, Dom.
Well, you know where my mark is right now. I'm lazing everything that has to do with candy canes and eggnog because tis the season for strategist target prices in the S&P. And the early results look kind of like the same playbook we saw from early 2017, which is to say up market, but not up by that much. For example, you got Morgan Stanley's Mike Wilson, who just put out a 12-month 2750 S&P 500 target. It's about 6% higher than now. That's pretty okay. CFRA's Sam Stovall is predicting just 2640, which is about a percent or so higher from here. Not raging bulls. You got Canaccord's Tony Dwyer. He thinks 2800. That's about 8%, which is more on the bullish side. And then there's Jonathan Golub over at Credit Suisse. He's got one of the higher targets so far early on in the season, 2875. That's close to 10% higher than here. It's not exactly like what Wall Street thought at the end of 2016, but the feeling is there. Bull, but not full bull. Now, it's worth noting early on, among the folks who got it pretty close to right at the end of last year calling this year end were then RBC's Jonathan Golub and then Binky Chadha over at Deutsche Bank. So why aren't Wall Street's paid predictors more bullish on the market after not generally being bullish enough about this year? It might be that we're poised to have our seventh positive year in the last nine, with only flat to very slight declines in those two other years, and double-digit or very close to double-digit increases during those 7 years as well. It's fair to say that developments out of Washington will be a big part of the story in the coming weeks and months. And for more on where strategists are starting to stack up when it comes to next year, go and check out the story on CNBC.com right now, where we'll be tracking forecasts as they file in and updating as they change. Back to you, Melissa.
All right. Thank you very much, Dom. So why won't Wall Street go full bull? Raise their target to 3,000. So I go to the skeptic, Dan.
Oh, really? I thought you were going to go to the day. Listen, I think a lot of people didn't expect to see these sorts of gains this year, no matter who won that election. So I think part of it is just being a little careful in front of what is a whole heck of a lot of uncertainty, especially on the legislative front, especially on the stimulus front, that sort of thing. So to me, you know, I get everything. I get all the reasons. I get earnings expansion, this and that, whatever. But to me, at the end of the day, I think it makes sense, especially as we get into Q1.
What do I do with these forecasts, in November of 2017, listening to them line up for 2018?
Not much.
Yeah.
Not much, because what they also don't tell you is what's going to happen in the middle of the year. And if you think about a market where we've had zero volatility, and I don't care who you want to talk to of that list of guys, to say that it's just going to have a nice, calm Lake Placid with the duck or whatever you were doing underneath the surface.
Yeah.
But clearly we're in a place here where I think there are a number of very big events. And this is a market that's at a valuation that's very difficult to justify unless you see rates stay at 230, which does not equate to an economy that's growing. We have 3 to 3.5% GDP the last 2 quarters. We'll probably go more in the fourth quarter. It's hard to keep that market down with rates at 230.
And to be fair to these strategists, they will change it over the year, right? They'll evaluate as what's going on. It's very difficult to look out a year from now. That's part of their job to say that. I think it's prudent to be cautious. If you're the one that's out there, you know, you do have a little bit of career risk, maybe not career risk, but let's call it embarrassment risk. You're the one out there having the highest thing. And also,
career risk is missing this rally, though, to be clear. It's the guys that were saying it wasn't going higher when it went higher that are already out of jobs. I mean, that's where you lose your job on the street.
Up next, check out this mystery chart. It has been a rough month for this one group of stocks, but could this be your best chance to buy? We'll tell you why traders are betting big on a turnaround right after this.
Ooh.
Welcome back. The regional banking stocks seriously underperforming the broader market this year, but maybe not for long. So, Dan, what'd you see?
Yeah, there was one large trade today when the KRE was trading 56.11 shortly after the opening. There was a buyer 14,000 of the December 57 calls, paying 70 cents to open. Those things break even. Look at this right here. This is this little flag. The chart's been in here right about here. So, obviously, December expiration, possibly targeting the December 13th Fed meeting. Real quickly here, as we go to the other chart, maybe this trader just sees a nice little flag. They're playing for a breakout between now and mid-December.
All right. Thanks for that, Dan. Up next, final trades. Final trade, Tim.
70 on Gilead. Get there.
BK.
Amazon, I think you sell some here.
Dan.
XRT, 42 is the top of the year.
Keith.
Novo, man. He's just getting it done.
40,000 easily. 40,000.
He didn't say easily.
You know what else is crazy? JWN, Nordstrom. So I think that gets it done.
Talk it down. I'm Melissa Lee. Thanks so much for watching. See you back here tomorrow at 5 for more Fast Money. Meantime, Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.